Did y'all watch that documentary about, the comedian who played the other comedian and...
Jim Carrey and Andy Kaufman? Wait, really? I got it. Wow.
I love both of you so much. Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 65. I'm Anita Sarkeesian, and apparently I forgot that for a moment. I am joined, as always, by my two other people who were not even asked to host the Oscars this year, Carolyn Pettit.
Hello.
And Ebony Adams.
Hey, it's an honor just to be nominated.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today, we're going to be talking about the Academy Awards as an institution, some of the problems with it, some of the issues we have with it, and we're also going to be talking about some of the worst wins in Oscar history. After that, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freak Out? Now on with the show. Hello, my fellow non-Oscar nominated humans.
Hi.
Hi.
It's a blow. It's a blow. Once again, my work has been ignored by the Academy.
Every year. Every
year. Fuck the Academy.
I say that, you know, the approval of my peers doesn't matter, but it does. It does. It'd be nice to be recognized.
I mean, I don't approve of you, so it's true.
Right, but I'm talking about my peers, Anita, not my subordinates.
I think it was Bob Hope, who was a multi-time Oscar host, once joked, you know, it's always exciting the day that the Academy Award nominations are announced, or as we call it at my house, Passover.
Wow.
Hey, yo.
Yep, yep.
Funny, Bob. I was just at his airport.
You were, yeah.
I was. There's a big statue of him. I pray to it every time I walk by. I don't really. Okay.
That's weird.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have strong feelings. Although I did used to live around the corner from where he lived. It was like this big gate. Then none of this matters.
No.
Why don't we just do the entertainment news?
All right.
Oh, President's Day episode. Get into it.
I did not used to live near any president. Fact.
don't try
you
and
really
walk
gotta
it back
change
now.
That.
I mean, we'll come back to that in the bonus.
Life goals, live near a president at some point.
I mean, I'll just, like, piggyback on their security, you know?
Yeah, that's definitely how it works, Anita. That's definitely how it works.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. All right, Carolyn, give us some reprieve from this bullshit of my tiredness, please.
All right, so I've got it. It's more bullshit. It's just a different kind of bullshit. So, all right, two words that inspire confidence in me every time I hear them. Bill Maher.
Can we cancel that?
So,
You're fired from this job. Ebony, you're taking over.
Oh, God.
So this is, I'm pulling from a story in the Daily Beast, but during a rant on his HBO show Real Time about how, according to him, the Oscars this year are too politically correct, he said this, talking about Green Book, which, of course, is one of this year's nominees, the one we here at Feminist Frequency are really rooting for.
Can I stop you just
not,
real
that
quick?
That sounded way too serious and not sarcastic enough.
Carol, can I just stop you real quick and say, Bill Maher plus Green Book plus Oscars too politically correct. Like,
just the alchemy of,
exactly,
of those,
like,
three things.
There's no way this is something that's going to sit right with me. So,
no.
Okay, I just had to take a moment. I'm sorry. Please,
so,
continue.
So this is what he said during, part of what he said during his rant. Green Book is a movie made by liberals for liberals, bursting at the seams with liberal values. Not good enough, right? Like, he's not saying the Green Book is not good enough. He's saying that all of us are saying that it's not good enough, which it fucking isn't. He goes on to say,
Carolyn just swore.
She's
real. She's
I get fired up
morning.
About. I get fired up about movies. Maher went on to say, because the director is one of the Farrelly brothers, and as an inside joke for his crew, he used to pull his weenie out on movies like Dumb and Dumber. Fuck, the poster for Something About Mary showed Cameron Diaz's hair styled with Ben Stiller's cum. I say he should get an award for just growing up. So he's totally, like, making light of the fact that Peter Farrelly, the Oscar-nominated director of Green Book, used to just casually pull out his dick You know, when shooting scenes like with actresses and I mean, my understanding is something he would do.
I love how telling this statement is, but not, you know, in the way that Bill Maher expects. So like, one, he is absolutely right that this is a movie created by liberals for liberals.
Oh, 100%.
Like classic Hollywood self-congratulatory white liberals, right? Like, of course, they salivate all over a movie like this.
But Bill Maher is saying that they should and we should and that we should all like be in love with this movie.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, well, you know, actually the people who are criticizing this movie are not standard, you know, issue, generic Hollywood white liberal. So yeah, of course we hate this movie. But then also the notion that like someone should be applauded, congratulated, you know, for growing up, like for not being assholes anymore.
For not, you know, like, doing,
you
like,
just have to do the absolute least. And we're supposed to be like just falling all over ourselves, being grateful that you no longer show your weenie.
That's
to
that
people.
Was the word. Yes. I mean, and this is like creating, I mean, that's just completely inappropriate workplace behavior. My God. Like, that's what Louis C.K. used to do. Yeah. It's,
But
God.
He doesn't do it anymore, Carolyn. So can't we acknowledge that he doesn't do it anymore?
Let's all praise Louis C.K. for growing up. If he doesn't do that anymore, then give him a big welcome back congratulatory tour. In other news, the video game industry was really
shaken. You're killing me this morning.
What? No.
Carolyn, are you starting to feel like you aren't appreciated? Like, we ask you to bring us celebrity news or pop culture news every week, and every week we give you the business about it.
Well, this is not like there's plenty of sexual harassment and stuff in the video game industry, but this is not a sexual harassment story. This is a labor story. The video game industry was shaken as Activision Blizzard laid off 800 employees.
Holy shit. How did I not hear about this? Sorry.
I don't know.
you need to check the Pop Talk channel in Slack a little. I know I go overboard. So part of the reason stuff for our listeners. I post a lot of stuff in our Pop Talk channel, and part of the reason for that is that's where I go back to when I prepare each week's entertainment news so I can see all the stories from the week and decide what I feel
she
is
really
like.
She really does it because I don't pay attention to anything. Well, that's the only too. Way I get
I mean,
my
I
news.
Really feel like, yeah, maybe I should start when I think a story really, you know, something you really should be aware of, I'll tag you. Hey, Anita, you really need to look at this.
It won't matter. As someone who tags Anita about 47 times a day,
it will not matter. I go back. I actually go back, but I take it in these big digests. So like, it'll be like 2 weeks, and I'll be like, "Holy shit!"
And I know. I love it when you react to something, and I have to scroll back and be like, "What are you talking? Oh my god, you're just now reacting to that." So Activision Blizzard laid off 800 employees, about 8% of their total workforce, while also posting record profits. So I really want to give props to Patrick Klepek of Waypoint for his reporting on this issue. It's the kind of reporting this story I think really demands, because they ran with the headline, Activision Blizzard reports record revenue as they fuck over 800 employees. And So quoting a bit from Klepek's story, he says, you know, after mentioning the layoffs of 800 people, he says, they're a company who bragged about having a record year on an earnings call this afternoon, a quarter where only raking in $2.4 billion in revenue was considered a disappointment. They are a company who granted a $15 million signing bonus and a $900,000 salary to a high-ranking executive who joined last month. And they're a company who just laid off around 800 employees. This story is it's infuriating. It's so infuriating. But the rage within, at least within my kind of Twitter and gaming circles, you know, has been so palpable, and so much the talk about just labor organization in the games industry is just getting louder and louder and louder that, the optimist in me wants to believe that we are approaching a tipping point where executives just won't be able to to award themselves such massive bonuses and salaries while, you know, laying off hundreds of working people like this, at least to this degree. Because
the other thing that's happening in games right now is the, like, kind of, I mean, this isn't new, but starting last year, there's been building momentum and talking about union building in game, in video game industry. And that is actually, like, starting to get a little bit more organized and a little bit louder, and more conversations are happening around it. So I really do have some hope that maybe we'll start seeing a little more, like, equity in labor practices in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, as someone unlike you and Carolyn, Anita, because I don't have the background in the video game industry, I am still only learning about the way that developers and coders and writers and, you know, people at kind of all levels beneath the top, of course, are exploited, particularly the people who work sort of on a contract basis or freelance basis. I mean, as someone from outside, you know, it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking like these are people doing creative work that they desperately want to be doing. And, you know, I see like the money flowing into that industry and I assume that they're being remunerated properly. But of course they aren't, right? And so being the naive person that I was and not knowing anything about the industry, learning about like, I don't even remember what the name of it is called, but people working like 80-100 hour weeks.
Yeah, crunch.
Crunch, that's it.
A culture crunch. Of crunch, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and the notion that you should be grateful to have a position like that, you know, that you should be grateful to run yourself ragged, to not be able to have, you know, a life outside of that crunch time, to have your health go to shit, to have your relationships go to shit, you know, and then to also not be paid fairly for that. Like, fuck. This whole capitalism is a trap, yo. Capitalism is a trap.
Absolutely. Yeah. Before we wrap up entertainment news this week, I do want to share one story that has just, you know, put a little spring in my step these past few days. And that is that this week on Saturday Night Live, host Don Cheadle, during one of the little segments where the host's job is to just, you know, introduce the musical guest, he wore a shirt that said "Protect Trans Kids." And like,
we stan.
Yeah,
forever.
Absolutely. Like, just what a powerful gesture, you know? I mean, it's like, it's kind of weird to say, like, just wearing a t-shirt it would be a powerful gesture, but it really was, I think, tremendously meaningful for him to do that. And, you know, like, obviously, like, the response on Twitter, of course, has been huge. And I'm really grateful to him for doing that. I think it was a really awesome thing to do.
Yeah. Don Cheadle, we love.
Yes, indeed.
And as people are saying on Twitter, that's why you survived the end of Infinity War.
Right.
You were a real one.
All those tweets that, yeah, there's one last night that's Don Cheadle in the Protect Trans Kids shirt and, you know, Mark Ruffalo in a march, you know, holding a banner that says confront white supremacy. And it says, like, this is why they survived the snap. You know, Mark Ruffalo. You know, he slips up sometimes for sure, but on the whole, like I really I appreciate his outspoken politics as well.
I think you love his little smiles.
I do. I mean, gosh, he is one of my favorite actors. I think. I mean, I just love seeing him and stuff. I think
he just seems so
great.
Genuinely warm as a person.
Yeah, he's very good at doing genuine warmth. Mm-hmm. And yeah, exactly. I love that.
Nice.
Did you know that it is because of you that we can keep bringing Feminist Frequency Radio to the airwaves? It's true. We are listener supported. So please consider joining our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak, where you'll get access to some fun perks and bonus episodes. And if you have a Kickstarter account, it's super easy because that's all you need to start a Drip account. Ta-da! So please join us at d.rip/femfreak. All right. The 2019 Academy Awards are taking place this upcoming Sunday. Watched every year by tens of millions of movie fans around the world, the Oscars are the film industry's most high-profile opportunity to celebrate itself and to shape our collective notions of what cinematic excellence looks like. And boy, do they get it wrong sometimes. This week, we're going to look back at what we think are some of the most wrongheaded or just plain embarrassing victories in Oscar history. And also, I think we should chat a little bit just about like the Oscars and the Academy in general and like how the Oscars like why they are how they are.
Can I ask you both just to begin, like, do y'all actually watch the Oscars regularly?
When I was young, like up through probably my mid 20s, like I was definitely a big Oscar viewer. Like, when I say a big Oscar viewer, what I mean is that I would kind of in the weeks leading up to the Oscars, like I'd try to see a lot of the Best Picture nominees. You know, I might feel strongly about, oh, this performance should definitely win, like Best Actor or, you know, what have you. I would have kind of strong feelings about those things. And then at a certain point, like, you know, the whole sense of like the Oscars really meaning anything just kind of evaporated for me. I like sort of woke up and I understood like, well, this doesn't, I mean, so my feeling on the Oscars now is the only reason they matter is because we think they matter, right? Like they have the power. The reason we have to talk about them, or, you know, or the reason we do talk about them, I think, is because, you know, they do have the power to shape what people think, you know, great film looks like. And that's important, right? So when they recognize a film like Moonlight, it can be meaningful. But also when they just constantly recognize films that center white actors, white experiences, and so on, like that is also meaningful, but not in the same way. So now I'm kind of back to watching the Oscars and caring about the Oscars, but from a very different place, right? A place of like, how are we, what are the Oscars perpetuating this year kind of thing?
The Oscars mean something, as you say, because we agree collectively, it's like currency. We agree collectively that they matter. And so they matter, you know? And so there's this kind of like ball juggling that has to happen with this. But also, so I'm 87 years old. And I do remember watching the Oscars in the same way that I used to watch like the Miss America pageant or, you know, the Grammys or the American Music Awards or whatever, because there was definitely a sense, you know, before this, you know, current era where there are so many other options to watch and things people are accustomed to not watching things together, that there was a collective viewing experience that gave the Oscars power. Even as a kid, like, yeah, people would talk about it the next day at school. But it's been so long since that's been the case for me that I've actually sat down and watched the show. And so preparing to talk about the Oscars today, I sat down and was thinking, like, when was the last time I actually watched the Oscars, like, top to bottom? And it has to have been like 15 years. It has to have been, you know, I will watch stuff, you know, the day after, because someone has, you know, graciously recapped the most important moments or the most what the fuck moments, but actually sitting down and watching it, I haven't had that experience in forever. And I don't feel as if I'm missing anything.
I will watch it occasionally. I don't like go out of my way, but sometimes I'm like, oh, the Oscars are on tonight. Let me watch them. It's always excruciating. Like, it's always a really rough experience. And, you know, part of it is like what Carolyn's talking about. Like, I think there is a value to us as media critics, like understanding what is being perceived as important and what, you know, and it allows us some space to, you know, I don't know. I think that awards are just brutal to watch and they mean so much still. Right. Like everyone talks shit about them, but they really do. Right. Like you see like Oscar nominated actor in this movie and you're like, oh, there's value to that. So I think that like getting into this conversation there, it's relevant to look at how like we like how this happens. Right. Like I think it's important to understand that this isn't just like, oh, 600 movies are made a year and the creme de la creme rises to the top. It's like they actually campaign behind the scenes. So there is a whole budget that is put together by studios and publishers. This isn't video games. Studios, right? That like put money, budgeting money together to send their actors and their directors to events to like curry favor with the Academy, right? Like there are billboards, there are events that are not televised that are just them trying to get people to like vote for them. It's not like it just is on the merits of the film alone.
And right? These things get really fierce. Like, I remember in the one I in particular remember hearing so much about was the year that both Saving Private Ryan and Shakespeare in Love were nominated. Like, Shakespeare, the Miramax, the studio behind Shakespeare in Love, like, funneled so much money and was so aggressive within the industry in their lobbying for that film. And it did ultimately win Best Picture, which was a surprise to a great many people who thought that Private Ryan kind of had it on lock, or that Private Ryan was the more, like, deserving film, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and that, like, yeah, lobbying is the word I was looking for. Thank you. It's very... It's very insincere, and we don't see that. Like, with a presidential election, we see the, like, we see what's happening, right? Because it's us that they're trying to get votes from. But otherwise, you just think the Academy Awards, like, as a kid, is just like, oh, this is just the best stuff, right? And it's not. And I think there was a story a few years ago about God, I wish I could remember who it was, but they were like, we're not putting any money into Oscars this year. Like, we're going to take that money and use it for something better. And, like, that was this moment where I'm like, oh, you are choosing to not play this fucking game. And there is a cost to that.
Yes. And also to your point of, like, as a kid, just accepting, like, so as a kid, like, and I mean, I just accepted that, oh, the Oscars are, like, what's best. And so one of my favorite Oscar moments now, but that made me uncomfortable at the time, was that I think it was at the 1990 Oscar ceremony, and the nominees were Driving Miss Daisy, which is a kind of interesting mirror of Green Book this year, but, you know, Dead Poets Society, Field of Dreams, My Left Foot, and Born on the 4th of July. And Kim Basinger came out. Each movie had, like, a celebrity who came out to give a little spiel about it, all the Best Picture nominees. And she was going to do Dead Poets Society. But before she got into her scripted spiel, you could tell she was, like, pretty nervous. But she said, like, I really have to call attention to a film that isn't nominated this year. Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. And, like, as a kid for me, that moment made me so uncomfortable because I was like, wait, what? Like, because I hadn't seen Do the Right Thing or anything. And I'm like, but now I look back on that moment and I'm like, fuck yeah. Like, thank you at least for giving voice to that and, like, acknowledging that there was, like, some serious racial, you know, bias, to say the least, in the Oscar voting.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, we spend enough time reckoning with how ultimately parochial the Oscars are, because it does have a global audience and a global reach and global influence. But there is, you know, one sort of main, like, foreign language category, right? And it's a big deal that the lead actor from Roma is nominated this year. But that rarely happens. But there's still the sense that, like, these are the best movies of the world. Like, these 10 movies were the best in cinema that came out from the world. And it's like, no, these are the ones with the biggest marketing budget and, you know, the biggest, like, you know, Oscar engine behind them. It has only tangential relation to the actual quality, you know, of the output this year.
You remember, I think it was 2015, or 2016, the Oscar So White hashtag.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about that, definitely.
Yeah. Who was it that, I forget, who was it that made
April
that?
April Rain?
Yes, thank you. So I thought that was a really interesting moment because, you know, that to me is a very indicative zeitgeist change. Right. Like, before that, the Oscars and the Academy Awards in Hollywood weren't really listening as this rise of voices were getting louder online and getting more space to talk about how white, cisgendered, male the film industry and Hollywood in general is. And the fact that that got so much attention and traction, I think, is very much indicative of the shift that people have been pushing for in this sort of feminist intersectional media criticism space, intersectional feminist media criticism space. And the Oscars had to deal with that, because it was so big. And you saw all of these jokes and all of these comments about it. And so we're in this space now where we're a little bit further away from that, where you can't get away with the same kinds of overtly aggressive dismissal and erasure, but it's still happening. And I think that that's an interesting, we're in a time where you're like, well, we have to acknowledge the existence of all of these people who are like, fuck you, you're not acknowledging us. But we aren't ready to actually do that. And so one of the things that I think is interesting about watching the Oscars is watching them walk on eggshells, trying to figure out how to deal with this particular like liminal space that we're in as the industry is like creeching and like screeching forward in some ways.
I think that the industry is ready to make jokes about the fact that it is overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly cisgender, etc., but is not actually ready to make any changes along those lines. So I think, you know, having hosts who poke fun at Oscars so white is something that, you know, people can have, can laugh uproariously from the audience. But how many white people actually, you know, boycotted the Oscars because of it, you know? How many Academy members are like, yeah, I refuse to take part in this anymore? I think, you know, people are very comfortable saying like, yeah, this is a problem, but we're not actually going to do anything about it. Or we will make the most token, you know, sort of attempts to address this. And you better be happy with it, you know. But meanwhile, they see, you know, like relevance leech away year by year as, you know, people are just like, yeah, this doesn't reflect what I watch, what I admire, what I valued in cinema this year. So why should I pay any attention to it?
Well, and the tokenism is the issue here, I think, for a lot of us, in that, like, the Best Picture category has several stories about and starring people of color in a way that this is not normal for a Best Picture category, and it should be, although we can talk about, like, the contents of those films and why they're problematic, but, it doesn't mean that they're going to win. It means that, like, I feel like they're throwing us a bone. And I wanted to bring up, so I've talked about Alan Johnson a bunch, who his work has been very influential in my understanding of systems of privilege and oppression. And one of the things that he talks about as a part of patriarchy, one of the sort of like tenets of it, is male-centeredness. And this applies to white supremacy as well, when you can just say it's white centeredness. And so I'm going to use gender here because I have the data in front of me on this. But the idea of male centeredness is that just the focus of attention is primarily on men and what they do. So white centeredness would be what white people do, right? And if you look at, you know, hearkening back to what Carolyn is saying, is the importance of the symbolism of what the Best Picture winner means. If you look back at the stories that are won, there are, in since they started nominating Best Picture as we have it today, which is since 1965, I believe, there have only been 5 movies starring a woman that has made it to, that has won in all of those years. And they are often about being women. So the thing about the movies that we have, these movies, we have three movies about black people on the Best Picture list. I think we have five about people of color, but they are usually about being, it is usually about being a person of color, not just a human in the world.
Sure. I mean, right? In the 2013 Best Picture winner was 12 Years a Slave, which, I mean, you know, may be a very well-made, very powerful film about slavery and may be deserving of accolades. I'm not saying that it is or it isn't, but I think it's indicative of the kind of story about black people that white Academy voters are comfortable with, for a few reasons. One, it depicts a kind of racism as that. Something that we can dismiss as, oh, that racism is in the past, that was a long time ago. It's you know, not about, it's about black people being oppressed and being slaves.
And you've got a white dude that comes in and saves them, right? Like, it literally, Brad Pitt comes in at the end of the movie and is like, I got you, man.
Wow.
And you're are you fucking kidding me?
Right. So white Academy voters like films that are comforting stories about race, right? But they don't like, generally speaking, stories that are challenging about white supremacy, yeah, that force them to confront white supremacy as something that exists now and that we are still grappling with, and that that you, the viewer, the white viewer, may be, are complicit in.
Yeah. I want to point out a couple of examples of this because I have this list in front of me. So 12 Years a Slave is an example of that. Argo is an example of that because it is about Iran, but it is about a white dude, right?
Well, and that film whitewashes the main character because the real person, the real completely. Man was brown, and they, yep. But Ben Affleck plays him in the movie.
Yep, totally. The Hurt Locker is about war, but it centers white people. Slumdog Millionaire is about a brown kid that is about being poor and impoverished. Like, it's about being brown. Crash is a fucking nightmare of a film. Right? So those are just examples I listed out since 2003, right? It's very indicative of the fact that people of color only get to be celebrated when they show us how miserable it is to be a person of color, right?
Yeah, yes. Exactly. You know, or the same is true for like disabled folks. Like,
yep.
If it's not inspiration porn, we apparently don't want it. There are very specific stories that we're allowed to tell. If we are, if we deviate in any way from the party line of being white, cisgender, abled, etc. And if you can find a way to tell a story that is about trauma, the trauma of Black people or the trauma of, women or the trauma of disabled people, but find like a heroic white guy to put in it, I'm looking at you, Hidden Figures, then people will eat that shit up. And but not to say that I didn't like Hidden Figures, I did, but like Kevin Costner had to be in that movie for that movie to get made and, for it to receive kind of the push that it did. Like, there's always going to be that white figure.
And this year's no different, right? You've got Black Panther, which is 100% about race. You've got Black Klansman, which is 100% about race. You've got Green Book, which is about... race.
A white guy. a white guy's version of race.
If Green Book wins this year, which it probably will, which pains me to say that, it will, in my mind, essentially be a repeat of Crash winning because they're both, what I call feel-good movies about racism, right? Like, you come out feeling, like, at least the white viewer is encouraged to come out of it feeling like, well, I'm not racist. I mean, I'm nothing like the white people who were shown as bad in that movie. Therefore, like, I'm one of the good ones.
Can I bring up Moonlight real quick? Was one that I didn't mention. So that won Best Picture in 2017. You might remember that was the disaster
exactly.
Year.
Like, we almost didn't know that it won.
Yeah. So Moonlight again is a film about race and sexuality. Those identity markers are very central to the story. I don't know how to categorize that in terms of this conversation.
Because I think it's an insider's look. I think it's a story about race and sexuality from the perspective of an insider in that community versus an outsider. So it's not a Peter Farrelly movie, thank God, as a white man writing the story of, a queer Black boy growing into manhood. Like, that's the difference.
It's also not about a historical moment in time, right? It's very much confronting you today with this is the reality today and like around you, like this is happening right now kind of thing. So I do feel like that one stands out. It stands out in a lot of ways for me.
Well, in the same way, if we're going to talk about Barry Jenkins, you have If Beale Street Could Talk.
How is that not a nominee for Best Picture?
Again, like the fact that the Academy would choose to recognize a film like Green Book over a film like If Beale Street Could Talk is mind-boggling, but so unsurprising. Barry Jenkins is producing, like... I cannot explain to you how beautiful a film If Beale Street Could Talk is because of the people who created it, the people who birthed that wonderful gem of a movie, It is worlds different from something like Green Book, but Hollywood is not interested in the same way.
Or the gatekeepers of Hollywood, I would say, right?
I mean, Green Book is I mean, it's like the filmmaking isn't even interesting. It's just a, no. It's a very workmanlike, you know, straightforward, you know, what I kind of disparagingly like to call a competent, you know, film in terms of its like direction. Like, but I mean, God, if Beale Street Could Talk, I mean, those images, just like, I mean, they're so luminous. They're so beautiful. And the way Jink, I mean, that is like, it is true filmmaking. Like, you watch a film like If Beale Street Could Talk, and you know you are watching a film by a great filmmaker. Yes. And, you know, you come out of Green Book, and it's like, that was a movie, whatever. Like, it's disposable. I mean, issues of, like, it's really troubling issues of race aside, like, even just structurally and in terms of the cinematography and filmmaking and everything, it's disposable as a movie.
Yeah. It absolutely is. And it hurts my heart that Mahershala Ali was in that film because he is so amazing.
So good.
It was so much better, deserves so much more than that movie. And so, and he was putting in the work in that film. And so while I love what he was able to do, I hate the work that he had to do in that film, particularly because, you know, the space that he is now taking on that nominee roster, you know, because there's usually a space for, you know, maybe one or two people of color, means that folks like Daniel Kaluuya is not getting nominated for Widows, you know, Tyree Henry is not getting nominated for Beale Street Could Talk, you know, like, I think are just fundamentally more dense, richer, you know, acting exercises because the material that they were working with was denser and more rich.
Can I bring up something totally unrelated before we run out of time?
Please.
Okay, one is a rant, really quickly. I am so annoyed at how much Hollywood loves talking about itself. So when things like Birdman and The Artist, which I liked The Artist, when, like, Hollywood just loves movies that are about writers, like that bullshit movie from fucking Woody Allen about the writer in Paris or whatever.
Oh yeah, Midnight in Paris.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Midnight in Paris. Like, I just, that annoys me. So I just wanted to put that out there. The thing I actually want to talk to you two about, though, is, so I'm very troubled by the gendering of these categories, right? That it's that women are categorized separate from men, and there's no space for non-binary folks, and just the huge problem with all of this, right? I tweeted about it recently, and some people gave me some really great feedback on that about how, like, we can't separate those distinctions until we actually have equity in the way that we perceive acting abilities. And the fear is that if we dismantle those categories, and men are just going to keep winning over and over again. And I think that that's fair. Like, that's, I mean, I don't think that we shouldn't dismantle the categories, but I think that that is a valid concern in terms of, like, how do we move forward in this time?
Yes. I mean, it's 100% true. And God, like, I don't have an answer for that, but I think the acknowledging the problem is a very important part of the process.
Yeah. I may have, sorry, I've just shut that conversation down.
No. I mean, it's such an interesting point.
It really bothers me a lot. Like, this is not a gendered thing. Acting is not a gendered thing. So why are we still today separating, like, the way that we look at, like, as if the way that a woman plays a role is different than the way a man plays a role.
Right, in some like fundamental way, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That just reminds me of this is kind of tangential, but really quickly, like, there was a great piece a year and a half or 2 years ago by Angelica Bastien, whose work we mentioned here on the show from time to time, about, like, specifically about what's the actor's name who played the trans character in Dallas Buyers Club and got the Oscar for that?
Oh, Jared Leto.
Jared Leto, right, thank you.
Oh my
God,
that was...
How he and actors like him have kind of made method acting this very, like, masculine kind of seeming thing, right? It's all about, like, this particular kind of, like, pain and work and everything, and how that's, like, fucking up our collective notions too of what good acting is and what it looks like in this, again, in this really kind of weirdly gendered way.
Did y'all watch that documentary about, the comedian who played the other comedian and...
Jim Carrey and Andy Kaufman? Wait, really? I got it. Wow.
I love both of you so much. But, like, how that kind of acting is so, like, celebrated, like you're saying. But, like, that documentary made me fucking hate Jim Carrey, like, with all of my goddamn soul. Because it's so awful. Like, if you're like, I'm going to inhabit this person for however long to play this role, like, everyone around you is treated like shit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, like, mm-hmm. you know, we were talking about Denzel, were we? What?
Yeah,
we were. How he, like, he does that too. Right? Like, I don't know. I'm not saying he treats people like shit, but, like, he's a method actor as well, if I'm remembering this correctly. And, like, if you're embodying these roles, yeah, Malcolm X. Okay, sorry. All these pieces are coming out. He did that with Malcolm X, I think, in terms of, like, for a year, he, like, lived that life to play that role. And it was a, you know, an incredible role, and he did an incredible job.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. But, like, what does that mean in terms of, like, you and the people around you and, like, the costs of the what we consider to be genius, right?
Exactly. The costs of and yeah. specifically male genius.
Right. I don't know anything about Denzel as a method actor or about what the experience of the people around him was like when he was doing Malcolm X. But going back to Jared Leto, do you remember when all those stories came out about how he was acting like a dick while he was the Joker? For Suicide Squad.
Yep.
And people were just like, yo, you need to do 100% less, Jared. This is so unnecessary. Like, this is never necessary. But also, you're just a dick. Like, this is not about you being the Joker. It's about what you think you can get away with in the name of being authentic for this role.
The thing about the Oscars, too, and, like, you know, when we talk about, like, the highlights and the moments, it's like, this is a huge platform that these people have. And when they get up on stage, there's the question about what is their thank you speech going to be? And we are always really excited when an actor uses that time to talk about something meaningful. Mm-hmm. And the hope is that, you know, if you did a film about a trans person or AIDS or race or whatever, you're gonna mention that, right? You're gonna talk about the issue that you just helped bring to light in some capacity. And fucking Jared Leto gets up there and was like, I had to wax my whole body.
Yeah.
Like, he literally said that as a part of his acceptance speech in, like, and that movie was really powerful. Like, I know it's super fucked up in terms of, like, who they cast and all of that shit. But, like, what the story they were trying to tell is a very powerful story and, like, a meaningful story. And, like, it sucks that the people who these people that we know who made it don't give a fuck. They just wanted, like, Oscar bait movies.
Yes. You know, speaking of, like, speeches and things, like, just briefly, you know, as we look ahead to this week's to the Sunday's Oscars, I mean, our mutual friend of the organization, Imran Siddiqui, has talked a lot about how, like, how white, you know, white actors are so centered on screen and so celebrated by the Academy Awards, and never once basically does a white actor when winning their Oscar ever acknowledge their white privilege or how whiteness has has basically given them the opportunities they've had or put them, you know, help them win that Oscar, help them, like, achieve that moment. They've never called attention to white supremacy, or they very rarely, if ever, call attention to white supremacy. And, you know, I don't expect that to be different this year, but I sure hope it is. I would love for someone to do that.
Agreed. All right, y'all. That was a conversation about the Oscars from us to you. And we are going to move on to...
What's your freak out?
Ebony, would you like to get us started?
Sure. I am freaking out about... So, okay. Y'all's president has decided he's going to declare a national emergency. So y'all's president is declaring a national emergency so that he can get, funding for this unnecessary and racist border wall. He's trying to convince y'all to fall for the okie doke.
Oh my God, Ebony.
So anyway, pictures were taken of him at Mar-a-Lago this weekend. And as always, conversations around Trump that purport to be about how utterly feckless he is as a statesman, as a president, you know, devolve into name-calling about his weight. And I'm sick of it. I have no love for y'all's president. Y'all know this. This is not, you know, like new news. But when you make fatphobic jokes about the president, it does not hurt Donald Trump. It hurts the fat people in your lives and the fat people around you who see how you characterize being fat, being overweight, being obese as something that's shameful, as something that's dirty, as something that's nasty, as something you would never, ever want to be. It's not funny. It's not clever. It's not new. Save it. Block, mute, I'm not doing this with y'all. There are so many things that we can and should be taking Donald Trump to task for. The fact that he lies about his weight is not even top 100 of the things that we need to be giving him the business for. It's tired. It's stop doing it. It's not funny. That's my freak out.
That is a wonderful freak out. Carolyn.
Yo.
What are you freaking out about?
I'm freaking out about this South Korean film that I just watched called Burning, and specifically about the performance in it by Steven Yeun. And Steven Yeun is, people know him, I guess, from like The Walking Dead, which I've never watched. I saw him in, he has a, you know, a small role in like Sorry to Bother You. I'm not very familiar with his body of work, but, you know, he is known to like American audiences in all the, in a number of like English speaking roles. This is a film, you know, made in South Korea. It's in Korean. It's an adaptation of a short story by the author Haruki Murakami, who's an author I really, really enjoy reading. I want to be very clear, like, Burning is not a feminist film. Murakami's work is definitely not feminist. It centers men invariably. Women are presented as like mysterious, you know, beings that just, you know, cause all kinds of trouble in men's lives.
But that checks out, though. That checks out.
Well, I mean, but I read Murakami because he has a fascinating dreamlike narrative style and way with language. That's fascinating. You know, issues of sort of the inherent kind of sexism, you know, aside. And Burning is, you know, is no different, really. It is not a feminist film. So I want to be clear that I'm not recommending it as a piece of feminist media. It is, however, a very fascinating film. And in particular, Steven Yeun. So I'm glad I watched a clip on YouTube from Conan O'Brien that's very funny, where, because I thought his name was pronounced Steven Yeun. And in this Conan O'Brien clip, like, Conan tells this story of how, like, him and Steven had spent so much time together. They'd done all these things, done all these segments for the show. They even went to Korea and filmed an episode over there together. And, you know, after all this, after, like, years and years coming back, Steven leans over to Conan and is like, you know, Steven, you've actually been pronouncing my last name wrong this whole time. It's Yeun. Because he's like so polite and everything. But anyway, in Burning, he plays a very enigmatic figure, a man who seems kind of detached from worldly concerns. He's wealthy. He's young. It's like another character kind of describes him as like the Great Gatsby. You know, he's this figure of mystery. And his performance in the film is just so compelling. It's just... it's so alluring, like it's so weirdly charismatic, that I, you know, like now I'm like excited about him as an actor when, you know, I didn't really know of him much before. You know, I do recommend Burning. It is a very singular film. You will not have seen much of anything like it. It has one of the most unforgettable ending scenes I've seen in a long, long time. You know, its gender issues are complex to be sure, but Steven Yeun is incredible in it.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. What's mine? Okay. I have two only because there was a special request for a specific freak out from me. I did an AMA on Instagram recently, and someone has asked me what I was listening to, and I just said that I was listening to James Blake's new album called Assume Form, and then someone asked me if I would freak out about it. So I wasn't planning on it, but here we go. I really like the album a lot. I don't know James. I've listened to songs of James Blake and I've liked his music, but I've never like sat down and listened to an entire album before this one. And this has guests, some really great guests on it. So Moses Sumney, who I've talked about before, who I think is amazing. You should all check out. Andre 3000 is on it. A woman named Rosalia, who I wasn't familiar with before, is on it. And it's, you know, if you don't know James Blake, like it's kind of... it's sort of like sad, depressing music. it's very moody, but I really like it a lot. So you can check that out if you are interested in that kind of a thing. What I really am going to freak out about is I went to a show this weekend called Tom Gunn Live, which is a Top Gun spoof. Did we talk about Point Break on here? Because, all right. This is a group of people who put together these spoof shows about movies, right? So I had seen them previously do one about Point Break. They also had one about Terminator. And so I was really excited to see the Top Gun spoof. They cast the protagonist from the audience at the beginning of the show. And so it is an audience member who is a part of it that reads lines from a card and gets kind of like moved around on stage, and it's super fun. It is playing in LA. I think they're doing a show in San Diego. It might travel around through California. I don't know if they really leave California, but I will put a link in the show notes if you are in any of those areas and want to check it out. It is not without some problems, which maybe I'll talk about in the bonus, but overall it's a really fun experience. I also brought a couple of friends who I didn't know until the show started that they've never seen Top Gun. I was like, how is this fun for you? And they had a great time. Like, it is just so over the top and ridiculous that it's kind of an entertaining time. Also, note, buy the $2 poncho. You're gonna want that.
Wow.
All right, so we would love to hear your freakouts, and you can do that by heading over to feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's FREQOUT. And really, you should do it to show Meg that there are people who want to freak out with us.
Poor Meg is like, geez, I was trying to help you, help you guys.
I don't think that was trying to help us, but that's okay. So please send us your freakouts. We want to know what you're thinking about and talking about, and we like to hear from you. So that's our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Please stay tuned for the bonus episode, which is only available if you are a backer of this podcast, which you can be so easily. Just head over to d.rip/femfreak. If you are a Star Trek Discovery fan, our podcast is still rolling, so you can check us out.
If you're a Discovery fan or if you hate watch Discovery.
Yes,
yeah,
true.
You'll welcome anyone, right? They don't have to be Discovery fans.
We will welcome anyone, really. You're allowed to join us in this. It's not as big of a hate fest as it was last season. Just saying.
And we've had two great guests already this season. So you should definitely check out this season of the Recap Freecast.
If you are enjoying our show, please rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends when you are sitting around at your goddamn Oscar party with your goddamn champagne and your little cards where you do your pre-voting or whatever bullshit y'all do. Be like, yo, I just listened to this great podcast about the Oscars. You should listen to it, too. I can hand you a script if you need it. So just, you know, ping me. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @FemFreak to stay up to date on all of the news. You can find me at Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
You can find me at Oscar So White. Just kidding. Ebony Aster.
Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. Technical support by Sarah Norales. Production assistance by Taylor Simmons. And art by Jamie Varon. We'll see you next week.
Bye. Later.